Good morning. Almost noon. Is it not working? Oh, great. Okay, let's see. Do you want to start? I don't want anything but safe mode. This is a disaster discussion. We're not going safe mode. Hi, I'm Aubrey Miller. I am the Senior Medical Advisor at the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, and that's NIH, and I'm really happy to be part of this discussion and kind of highlighting some of the work that we've been doing based on the challenges that Dr. Allori posed and some additional energies along this avenue of inquiry and activity. This is actually a perfect segue from Dr. Grossclose's last presentation, which was about public health practice. You know, it's what we do, and what we've been trained to do really well in response to emergencies is we get out in the field and we start collecting data and information quickly, and we get in and we do public health practice, and we do that well. I have nothing to disclose, so I added that slide. Okay. So fundamental questions, and Sam, you had, I think, three categories of questions, and I kind of put it down to two in my mind. And one question is it safe? You know, is it safe? I mean, that's what the community wants to know, whether it's Ebola, whether it's an oil spill, whether it's Katrina and I've got mold in my house, or did our strategies work when we actually wanted to do something, whether we were treating somebody for H1N1 with Paramivir, an antiviral drug, what did we actually learn? How did we use that information, or did we get the information to make positive decisions in the future, to actually do something better moving forward? And how do we get from public health practice to actually answer these questions? And I think, Sam, you kind of went into it in a way, and you asked some of those questions about, well, we have to think about all these things about should we do research, you know, can we answer the questions? But I also, I think, need to ask this question of we need to put ourselves in a position to do research timely. So we have to be, as we're doing and responding in our public health practice, can we do research in a timely way? So I kind of have the picture of the main highway. The main highway is our public health practice. We respond to a situation. And maybe we don't want to do research here. We don't have any questions that are that important. We can get the off-ramp. We want to be on a chance to take that main highway in a timely fashion. So, you know, can we use the public health practice system to identify the acute response platforms, whether it's surveillance or cross-sectional studies? Can we identify the cohorts, workers, the community members, the vulnerable populations that we actually want to find out and learn something to enable them to do better and to change the way we might implement things? And then get feedback from that acute response about what it is we should be looking at, because it's the acute response system that's identifying those research needs a lot of the times as well. They're figuring out things that are a problem as they're responding. This doesn't fit what we thought was going to be happening. This may be different. People are getting sick in ways we didn't expect to see. What do we really need to understand? Is the Ebola response really spot on? Are we missing something? Can we change it? And as Dr. Allori mentioned before, our responses have been slow. We miss critical data. The Deepwater Horizon oil response, which I'm going to talk about in a second, is a model. 9 months to start that Gulf study of 33,000 workers. The Hurricane Sandy response, 11 months. We're missing stuff. We got to do better. We got to bend that curve. And that's why we're here today. So the Gulf oil study, the Gulf oil spill response in 2010, as Dr. Allori mentioned, lots of supertanker spills in the last 50 years. Only 8 were studied, very small cross-sectional studies typically. One was this in Spain, the Prestige oil spill had some data, and they actually saw some respiratory effects and genotoxic effects in that population. Typically, almost no exposure data. You know, lots of oil spills, almost no exposure data to go with any human health data. And here we have the Deepwater Horizon, huge compared to the other ones, plus the addition of other chemicals called dispersants that were used here, and what do we really know, and how do we tell communities and workers about the long-term health effects? So let's talk about the public health responses, the public health practice elements of it, as creating a platform for research. So the acute response system, CDC was looking at the hospitals and trying to understand what were the admissions, what were the complaints that people were having. Poison control centers were involved. There were workplace reports that OSHA and NIOSH were looking through. NIOSH at CDC started to do some health investigations of select populations of workers that they could get to. We can get to this boat, we can get to this place, we can try to get some limited understanding of what the elephant looks like. I mean, this is a huge situation across four states, across the Gulf, with hundreds of thousands of people that were involved, and we're trying to get an understanding of what this looks like. Community assessment for Public Health Emergency Response, called CASPER, a tool that's been used to try to get a quick feel, was also deployed in Alabama. And community surveys by NGOs, other organizations, were getting information. CDC and others were saying, okay, here's what we're seeing, here's what we think is important. How do we use this as a springboard for health research? You know, how do we use these health and environmental investigations as a way to maybe say, hi, here's some issues. We also had worker education training going on. Could we also identify groups? And the NIOSH started to collect, well, as a roster. I think it was one of their first times of actually deploying this roster. Sam talked about it, the ERMS program, which is actually trying to say, okay, workers that are involved, you're going to sign up. We're going to figure out who you are, how we can identify who you are, some demographic information so we could find you later on. 55,000 people or so were identified in that roster as a springboard to doing research. And as Dr. Lurie mentioned, IOM came together and said, we should do research on this. There's not enough information about the long-term health effects. So NIH, through funding through various sources, also Dr. Collins from our Common Fund and also BP and others, contributed to a research project which involved both intramural research, a long study of workers that were involved, about 33,000 workers, that of the 130,000 workers that were actually involved. And these weren't common workers. These weren't just oil spill guys. These are people that had boats or people that were out of their jobs or lived by the beach and started becoming involved in cleaning up various activities along with it. We also worked with our extramural side of the house, which is academic universities. It was funded by a bunch of NIH institutes, by eight institutes coming together, pooling money, and identifying four academic centers and then 40 community-based partnerships to identify questions of concern to the community. So now you have research on workers, you have research with communities, starting late, but at least working in an interesting way of having both intramural and extramural activities and forming a coalition between the research community and the communities that were affected to identify problems and issues of concern that could be looked at. Interesting model. Also, our work education training program began to look at research about what do we understand about resiliency and workers' impacts here, and understanding some of the toxicology. What's in the oil? What's in these dispersants? How do they really affect health? And what do we know? About 80,000 chemicals are used in commerce today, of which we have very little information, and most of them, let alone in combination with each other. So the challenges. So defining who to study. How do you even figure out where they were? The workers were all over the place. They came from many locations. As we mentioned before, getting the tools together, protocols, contracts, support, IRB, etc., engaging diverse multicultural communities from the Vietnamese fishermen to Cajun and Creole populations, etc., up and down the coast, and trying to help understand what their impacts is and how does it affect them. And then little baseline data, both in environment and in health, about exposures. And then challenges of exposure reconstruction. So I'm not going to go into details about some of these, but these are just challenges we face in all kinds of research, and it really goes back to what Sam said, which is, can we do research? Can we answer those questions? Can we figure out what are the health effects here, and can we do it in a meaningful way? So as Dr. Lurie presented before, these issues about some of the strategies and priorities, you know, can we, experts, et cetera, et cetera. And they came together and they did worked with, in a great article with Dr. Lurie and Dr. Frieden and Dr. Collins, and basically laid out some challenges. And so we started a project about a year ago, which I'll talk about now, which is a disaster research project, where we said, you know, can we do this better? Can we start down the pathway of doing some of these things and then create maybe a platform that we can all begin to work off of, at least get in the game and start moving forward on this. So our disaster research project at NIEHS, and we're focusing really kind of on our environmental health world, but I think it's an opportunity for all sorts of strategies, whether you're doing clinical research or other types of research, to think about how you do things, who are your networks, who are your people that you work with in ways that you maybe implement it. So our objectives, one was, let's make the tools available. Sam, you mentioned mold. Heck, mold's been an issue for a long time, and mold ended up in Hurricane Sandy again as a big issue. And we're like, well, where's the tools for the researchers to be able to do stuff? And not just the federal research, the academic research, the community folks. You know, Louisiana Bucket Brigade was on the coast collecting information just as fast as the federal government was about some of the exposures. Rapid data collection capability to get some of the baseline data. The networks, as Dr. Lori mentioned, networks. We'll come back to that in a second about who goes your networks. But your network is the people you deal with on a routine basis. It's who you have a relationship in an ongoing way, and how do we use that relationship in a more creative way in order to help each other. And then integration, because we're not going to, if we build something and it's not integrated into the system or the emergency management system, which goes out and responds to the situation, but you want to help get some data that's important, doesn't include you or doesn't allow you to come into the situation safely, we're not going to be able to ever deploy any of this. So we began on an effort which I thought was really practical and simple, which would be to take the tools that are available that we all been creating for years and years at CDC, at NIH, and other places, and try to just make those tools available. Get it on a publicly accessible website, make those tools available. So we had our contract staff look through about 450 different tools and articles, et cetera, distilled out about 200 of those tools, whether they're surveys or protocols or EPI projects, things that are relevant, mold and respiratory, mental health, et cetera, resiliency tools, and get metadata about those tools. So how was it used? How long is it? You know, how long would it take to administer it? Is it in English and Spanish? Things like that, basic information, and try to get all that together. And now we'll come back to it, but we're hosting it. But also to create these tools to make it available to the research community across the country, regardless of whether you're, you know, because most situations are local, whether it's a fire or something just blew up in your backyard, a chemical factory, et cetera, you can do research and have these tools available. So that was the first start. So now we have 160 tools, which are now hosted at the National Library of Medicine. They have a page called the Disaster DMRC, Disaster Research Response website. And they're hosting these tools, and we're moving to a new work project with these tools, is to actually start to take tools that are publicly available. So right now this is linkage to the tools. We're trying to take the tools that are publicly available that you can use and start to create, let's tool building capacity. So people will be able to go on and say, I want to build something quickly. I want to build a survey tool. I want to build a protocol and be able to do some of this. So this is where we're moving to in the next several months. As Dr. Lori mentioned too, how do we get baseline data? How can we actually have protocols and things that can go through IRB, that we can begin to test the waters of IRB and OMB to make sure that we can actually use some of these, at least at the federal level, while we're trying to empower our academic and community-based partners at the federal level, how do we get to things faster? So we built what we call the RAPID tool, R-A-P-I-D-D. It's a protocol, and we took essentially 30 of the tools that were available. Things have been developed by CDC and others, and it has a range. It's almost like a menu. So is it a respiratory situation? Is it something that has dermal? Is it something I need resiliency? Do I want a mental health component? And we have about 35 of these tools in the RAPID protocol, and we've sent it to our IRB and said, hey, look at this now. Let's review this tool before the situation so you're comfortable with it. Maybe you can even come to a place where you can pre-approve it, and when something happens, we're going to modify this tool to actually give you a protocol quickly that we can get into the field. And our hope is, and now that's currently at our IRB, and our IRB is actually at NIEHS, has moved even further, not only like looking at the tool, but has also started thinking about what do we understand in terms of best practices for IRBs. You know, what are vulnerable populations in disasters? What do we need to know, and how does that feed into NIH FERB, as you'll hear about more coming up from Diane in just a few minutes. Also, we were trying to get intramural capability to be able to get to the field to use this tool, the rapid protocol, and collect information, collect biospecimens, do pulmonary function, etc. Is there a work population that's affected? Can we get there while they're being trained and get baseline data? Simultaneously, if you're going to build tools for people to use, you certainly want to train them to use them, both in terms of understanding, using tools, having information and guidance about them, but also training workers that may go to the field to be safe. Also to understand that you're part of a big federal response, if it is a federally declared thing, so you understand that you're working in the context of a FEMA response, you're part of the HHS, Emergency Support Function 8, etc., about the framework, so you don't show up there and say, I'm a researcher, I'm here to help. You're a researcher, you're here to help, but you need to understand what it is you're getting into, and to do it safely. So how do we train them to be safe? And Chip's going to talk a little bit more about training exercises in just a minute. Let me move along. The other piece of this is our research response network. So at NIH, our partners are typically our academic community, but our academic community's partners are the community. So in the community partnership research, we have a way of both training and being part of the academic community and the community simultaneously. But we thought we'd start what we call an EHS, or Research Response Network. And we're focusing right now, initially, is taking our centers. We fund centers in core centers in environmental health. We fund children's centers. We have centers for Superfund. We have worker training programs. And say, hey, let's get representatives from our centers all involved in this process. Instead of being a unidirectional thing where NIH funds something, we're trying to get the centers to help us build something at the same time. That we're trying to build tools for them at the same time that they can comment back and we can make it a bidirectional process where we make it better all the time. And also begin to go into this issue of what Dr. Laurie said before, who are the experts? For environmental health, we cover a wide gamut through our centers and through their partnerships across the country on environmental health issues. And we can ask them, what are the research questions? What are the research areas of importance? How do we get to them? And how do we make sure we build that into the system, the tools and things that are available moving forward from the group that's most involved and doing research in these areas over time? And also thinking about how to incorporate citizen science, the community partnerships, in a way that they can help us get data, both in terms of environmental data and in terms of human health information, because they're the ones in the situation. It's the workers that may be cleaning it up. It's the workers that may be experiencing a factory or something that blows up. It's the community around it that has the best to be able to get information and understand it and help us understand their needs. So looking forward, we're going to continue to develop the tools, and that platform's moving forward. We're going to be hosting on the National Library of Medicine. The site's already up. We're going to continue to evolve that. The rapid protocol I told you about, exercises. Chip's going to move in and talk a little bit about that. We're planning an exercise actually in Houston, coming toward February, and I think and I'll let Chip go on with a little bit of that. The other piece of the pie. So this last year we were focused a lot about trying to get timely human health information. Basic. Do it faster. Do it more timely. How do we understand the health effects? Set ourselves up off an acute response platform to move forward and get timely human health information, but also how do we get that environmental data to go with it? How do we understand what people are exposed to? How do we understand a little bit about the toxicology of these exposures, of really complicated exposures during disasters, and how that affects folks? And we actually now with the West Virginia spill is actually one of the first examples of our national toxicology program actually looking at high throughput research to understand some of the chemicals, which there's almost no data about the toxicology of it. So we're moving that direction. This is our challenge for the coming year, and we'll talk more about that perhaps during the question and answer. These are the folks in our leadership and groups that have been involved in this project, and these are the websites. And Chip, you're next. Can I get you? You don't want me trying to do it. Thank you.